Welcome back, everybody, to the Artist Care and Feeding podcast. I am Kathleen Falsani, your co-host, here with my co-host, Caitlin Barrett, and our producer, Mark Rivett. And today, we're welcoming just an absolutely fascinating human being, somebody that I've admired as a fellow journalist and writer for many, many years. Barbara Mahaney is a former pediatric oncology nurse, but that's not how she's best known. Barb spent nearly three decades as a reporter and a writer at the Chicago Tribune. She's now a freelance journalist, and in the time since she's left the Tribune, she's managed to write four collections of beautiful essays, the most recent of which is The Stillness of Winter, a gift book that came out a few months ago, and it's just the perfect gift for anybody, really, this time of year and as we head into the thickness of winter. Barbara is just a really lovely human being. That's when I think about running into her in the field as a reporter, as a cub reporter in Chicago. And Barb was always just lovely, and she still is. So delighted to welcome Barbara Mahaney to the show today. Welcome, Barb. We're so glad you're here.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you for coming on.
It's really wonderful to see your face. It's been way too long, my friend.
Really long time.
It's been a silly long amount of time. So we always start with the same question, which is, artistically speaking, how would you describe yourself?
Such a great question. I should have a really good answer. How would I describe myself artistically speaking? I don't think of myself artistically, for starters. I think of myself more as someone who is trying really hard to press against the heartbeat of the world around me, to pick up those rhythms and soft sounds.
Ooh.
And that might be because I used to be a nurse. So I'm a pulse taker.
Or like a human recording device, almost.
Or something. Yeah.
Well, and I could see that as in both that your vocation as a nurse and then your long vocation as a journalist. And I wasn't surprised that you didn't dive right into artists, because as journalists, we're like, we're just, yeoman. Yeah. What are you talking about?
We just take notes.
But the kind of journalism that you did and continue to do is, sure, you had breaking news and stuff, but what I think about is it is the kind of stories that come from paying attention to the softer and quieter side of life.
Absolutely.
A stethoscope. How about that, friend?
We're going to take this metaphor and keep going with it.
I'll keep coming up with them. It's okay. Just keep going.
I have the oldest stethoscope in the world upstairs. And whenever my kids were sick, they always wanted me to take it out because they thought it made me like know more.
Oh, well, obviously. Yeah.
Obviously.
It does make you look very official. You like hang it around your neck. It's very indicative what field you belong to.
That's exactly what we did. Oh, but
I don't trust any doctor without accoutrement. That's literally how it works. If you walk in with lots of stuff on, it is directly related to how much I trust you. If you walk in with a polo shirt on and that's it,
no.
I'm walking right out that office.
Yeah. And now they walk in with plastic shields and N95s.
Oh my gosh. Bless their hearts, all of them.
Yeah, I know.
What an insane time.
By the way,
I should have checked before this, but is everybody well in your family? Have you and Blair and the boys been okay?
Me and Blair and the boys are okay. Mm. Two of my brothers have had catastrophic things in the last week, part of why I was feeling pretty awful today.
I'm so sorry.
One, we think, has advanced head and neck cancer, and the other one had a major heart attack on Tuesday.
Oh, my God.
Oh, Barbara. I am so sorry.
I know.
In the middle of all this chaos.
And the one who had the heart attack, we've been in, constant touch ever since the other one, woke up with a lump on his neck, and by lunchtime was in the emergency room, had a CAT scan, and was told to run, not walk, to an oncologist. So the other afternoon, my third of four brothers called and said, Barb, I've got this really terrible heartburn, but I had banana peppers in my lunch and I had, and within minutes, the one with the stethoscope knew this was not just heartburn. So lo and behold, he was raced by ambulance to Maine Medical in Portland and is still in the intensive care unit.
Oh, my word. I'm so sorry.
Blessedly, no COVID, but...
To just to have any kind of issue, even minor, in the middle of all this is stressful. Yeah. I'm so very sorry.
Yeah.
Well,
it was really hard for his wife not to be able to jump in that ambulance.
I can't. Right. Yeah.
It's the age of COVID.
That has to be the hardest part of any family member, like going through anything like that. To be like, now this is happening and you have to wait outside.
Yeah. And they mean outside, like in the parking lot.
Right. In your car. Oh, my word. Well, jeepers.
But the rest of us, you know, we are hanging in there.
Good.
Hanging in there.
Okay. Well, I'm glad. And we'll be thinking of your brothers for sure.
Yeah. Prayers to your families for sure.
Thank you.
And you.
Thank you.
It's just, ugh. My God. Well, you know, this could not have been more of a dumpster fire of a year in every way for everyone. And, you know, you're one of the first, I'm a writer, obviously, but you're, and Caitlin writes as well, but you're the first, you know, I think writerly person we've had on here, really.
Author,
Author.
Is that true?
I think
we've had a poet.
We had a poet. Oh, we had Lucy. Lucy Shaw was on with us, so that's true.
Lucy Shaw.
Lucy Shaw, 92, just as.
They know each other.
A couple.
She's written a few poems.
A couple hundred books.
Yeah. This is amazing. Fine. Yeah, so we did have her on. Forgive me, Lucy won't be here. She won't hear this, but yeah. So, but I was thinking of somebody who, you know, isn't a poet. I think of her as a poet, although she writes everything. But and she's also prolific and has talked about how she has just been churning out poetry is how she's
like
responding to all of this.
40 poems that she's written this year since COVID, since the COVID lockdown. I know. She's one of she and David Wilcox. They're two of our guests.
A singer-songwriter who's
so prolific during this time. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Enviable.
Really. I've heard people say that. I have definitely heard, you know, I mean, if you're a person who processes through your art, you have a lot to process.
Well, interesting. That has not been the case with me. I have 50,000 things that I've started writing this year and finished only a few of them. Mm-hmm. And I find it, I have lots of ideas, but I feel when I'm in the midst of something, it's very hard for me to process it well enough to articulate anything that I think is meaningful. Mm-hmm. What about you? Are you able to, have you been able to write through this?
I do. So Stillness of Winter, I finished, literally my deadline was March 1st. So, I sent it off. And then the world stopped. So
my God, it's such a prescient book, given that you didn't write it during COVID. It's such.
And who knew it was coming?
No,
who knew it was coming?
But nobody. Right.
So for me, there's this imprint of, you know, this distant past, this time before we were all wrapped up in COVID that somehow still resonates for me. Cause I just have such a vivid memory of last winter, just, you know, sort of this seamless process of writing. Mm. Since COVID, you know, I've been writing. I started writing a blog when I was at the Tribune. Mm-hmm. I was writing for one of the feature sections and had been assigned a series on, I think it was called Family Passages. Mm-hmm. And I would basically embed with families who were going through, you know, life-changing times. A family who had just lost the father, a couple who was having, you know, their first baby, family who were becoming empty nesters and sending their youngest kid off to college. And I would spend weeks and weeks with these families.
When you say embed, do you mean like actually living there?
No. E-M-B-E-D, like embedded, like an embedded, like most
like you
embedded
do with,
reporters.
No,
are
no, no, no. I don't mean like, I don't mean like y'all are sleeping like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, toe to foot. I mean like when you, because you know, when I think embed, I mean like, Did you get a spare bedroom with them and live with them while you wrote, or were you just sort of like you were visiting them every day?
I was making house calls. Yes. I was mostly making house calls. I did travel to Georgetown when they dropped off their youngest kid, but other than that, I think it was house calls. Anyway, during that time, I just started, and we have two boys who happen to be 8 years apart. So at the time I was working on that series, my younger one was like 3, 4, 5. Mm. And the older one was, I guess, 11, 12, 13. And I just started, I got this idea that, you know, these quiet little stories that unfold in the confines of our own homes hold as much, you know, if you pay close attention, they hold as much beauty and wisdom and question, unanswered question often, as these families I was embedding with, but not in bed with. Let us be clear about that.
Now I can't stop picturing you. Head to foot, like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
I can't get that out of my head either.
I'm glad that's the picture in your head. Oh, Lordy. Lordy, Lordy. Anyway, so I started 14 years ago. I started writing this thing called Pull Up a Chair. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the first year, I wrote every single weekday morning, which was actually impressive. A terrifying thing. Yes. I'd been at the Chicago Tribune for 25 years when I started it, and I had front page stories, you know, all over the place. And that wasn't as scary to me as sitting in the dark in this little room every single morning and kind of just digging deep into my heart and writing about whatever bubbled up to the surface, you know, the most powerfully. Whatever most captivated my imagination, I would just write about it. And then I would hit publish without a copy editor, without an editor.
Those early days of like, start a blog. It's sort of like recording, but you don't have an editor at all. But you still are having the same platform.
No safety net. Anyway.
I mean, that's what journalism is now, right? The number of like terrible typos I've seen on articles I read. I'm like, I don't think they mean that there.
No.
I know. No editing. The Tribune got rid of all its copy editors. I hate to say. They got rid of a lot of things, but they did get rid of copy editors.
That's a deep, dark... This can take a very dark turn if we trot down that alley too very far about what's happened to journalism. But
Oh, I would love to.
No, I would very much not like to do that right now. So that's really sad.
Basically your question was, do you write? And yes, I still keep, you know, so the format for those is relatively short essays. Mm-hmm. And I no longer write every single weekday. I now write every single Friday.
But
can I ask one question about that?
Absolutely.
Did you have any kind of prompt for yourself that would give you a subject matter? How did you, so what did you decide to write on any given day? How did you?
Okay. So that became an interesting sort of process. I literally just would kind of survey the landscape of the previous 24 hours and whatever
the thing
floated to the top and felt the most potentially resonant was the thing I was going to dive into. Sometimes it might have been the most challenging episode of the day. Or just the one that made my heart feel like it was going to burst the most.
Right.
And then I knew there was something.
That is so vulnerable, right?
That's exactly what I was thinking.
To put yourself out there like that, to reveal. And I know that there's a lot of people doing that in many different ways on social media now, but it feels very structured and sculpted and specifically picture perfect-y.
Curated.
Curated.
In a different way than you're talking about.
And what you're talking about feels like vulnerable, skin-peeling reality. So... props, I think, is the word I'm looking at.
It's a very different muscle to switch from being a reporter to being an opinion writer or a columnist or an essayist. It's very, very different. And it's terrifying the first time you do it. And to try to remember that what you're experiencing and what you can see and what you understand and know is as valid as somebody you would interview about a topic. It's learning to trust your own, I don't know, it's not trusting your own voice, but your own experience in the world.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it didn't take too long until I found myself more often than not looking through a spiritual lens.
Yeah.
And I have said that, you know, I was kind of known at the Tribune for wearing my heart on my sleeve. I mean, I just like, it's just right there. And I had no bones about like showing it, blah, 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 blah. But it's a really scary other thing to wear your soul on your sleeve. And, you know, here I am in this Jewish Catholic marriage with a Jewish mother-in-law who was like the most loyal reader. And I always laugh. She's one of those, like, if she liked something, I would hear from her within 5 minutes.
Right.
If she didn't like something, I heard nothing. All day. And I just wondered.
That's
and
always
wondered,
stressful
wondered.
To me. Yes. Because when somebody does that to you, I'm always like, were you busy? Are they busy? No, they've been home all day. Why haven't I heard anything?
Yes. No, the deafening silence.
That's real. Right.
And it might be that their computer was broken, but you're probably not. You have committed the most mortal sin. To use the vernacular.
Offending the mother-in-law is just not a place you ever want to go. But, you know, as I was, first of all, this book is just so incredibly lovely. And as Caitlin said, you know, prescient. The stillness of winter. Having started working my way through it, it's very spiritual. It's very liturgical. It's got a very meditative feel to it. Mm-hmm. And as I was reading more and more, I'm like, gosh, we have a lot in common. Like we see the world in a similar spiritual, through a similar spiritual lens that maybe, you know, 20 years ago, it might have been looked a little different to the two of us, but I think we seem to be moving in the same direction. So I love this. And I know this was this based in part on one of your previous books? You've written four, is that right?
This is the book. Yeah, when Abingdon, this wasn't my idea. I've ended up loving this little thing, but
that's beautiful.
Abingdon, the former publisher of Abingdon just called me out of the blue a year ago, maybe September or October, and said, hey, we're thinking of putting together a line of, you know, pretty little gift books. They're from Nashville, so everything's pretty little. It's a pretty little book.
And it is, in fact, a pretty little book. It really is. Beautiful.
It's pretty. And so she said, you know, we're thinking of starting with Slowing Time, which was my first book, and which was arranged seasonally. It began with a winter and went through all the seasons back to a second winter. So it was the spiral of a year. So she said, you know, we just want to focus on just winter. You know, how do you feel about that? And I was like, sounds great to me. So once we started to pull it together, just because, you know, it's like, you know, having a big kettle of soup on the stove. You just got to keep throwing new things in it because maybe it'll get better. Maybe it'll get better. So I kept throwing things in and it was sort of hilarious. She's this wonderful Southern lady who, she says she can't cook for the life of her. She couldn't even peel a cucumber or something like that, but she loves recipes. So she kept telling me to add recipes and I was like, recipes. Okay. Recipes. Fine. So I think the recipes, you know, like the essays are mostly quieter and more contemplative. And then the essays sort of inject notes of whimsy. And it's a pastiche is what it turned into.
But it's a lovely pastiche. And I can't think of a better kind of a book for someone to hand somebody right now.
Yeah. Well, and when you talk about your blog, it feels like a more professionally edited version of that, where we're actually inside the life that you live, the recipes, the stories, the meditations, you know, like Kathleen said, if you're a person who loves winter, I do too. There is a very feeling of like, oh yes, this is mine. This is my life. These are the things I want. This feels very familiar to me.
Yeah. And it inspires a lot of, you know, that hygge feeling that the Scandinavians talk about. And it's like a little beautiful white book and I love, love, love cardinals. And I love Ranch with the Bear. I just love everything about this book. I love the font on the cover. Everything about it just makes me want to curl up with a fuzzy sweater and a fire crackling somewhere.
I want it to start snowing immediately. Like I look at this book I'm like, I need a snowstorm. Yes. And a fire.
Yeah. Have the fire. No snow. But
I'm always curious about that. How much of the like look of the book is you and how much is it like you're just farming out to somebody who knows a lot about making a book look good?
So this was amazing. Years and years ago, I was writing a story about this wonderful it was from California. It was this wonderful catalog of brilliantly curated children's books called The Chinaberry, Chinaberry something. Anyway, I wrote a profile of the founder of Chinaberry Books for the Tribune a long time ago. And I think she was the first person who told me that in most children's books, the illustrator and the author are, you know, two completely different entities. Yep. They don't talk to each other. The publisher sends, you know, and I thought, oh my God, how can that be? Because it's so often it's so completely synchronous. Right. And that exact thing happened with this book. So Abingdon hired this brilliant designer who I love so much, Jeff Jansen, who did, he worked on some of, you know, 1,000 Gifts.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Anne Boskamp's 1,000 Gifts. He worked on some parts of those collections. So they just sent him my stuff. We didn't talk. And I swear to God, when I saw the illustrations the first time, I was like, wait, did somebody send him a photograph of the raccoon at my door?
Seriously.
Like, that's my raccoon. Like, what's going on here?
The owl.
That's my raccoon.
The
and I wish I had an owl in my backyard.
Oh,
but
me too.
The only illustration that I thought was kind of funny was his illustration of brisket looks to me like slices of meatloaf.
I was going to say, he knows what brisket is. But and by the way, right now, totally brisket weather. I was thinking about this. Our oldest grandchild, we have 10 grandchildren, if you can believe that.
Wait, no, I can't, actually.
The older
now
Posleys,
I might fall off the chair.
10 of them. Oh my God. And our oldest one, Aiden, just turned 13 this week. And he asked for his favorite meal. All of the Posley kids, who are mostly Irish, all married Italians. Winning.
Of course.
Yeah. So there's lots of me happening in like my kind of background happening in the grandchildren. But his mother is a particularly great Italian cook. And so I was like, oh, what did he ask for? Her brujol? Or he's like, no, he wanted pot roast.
There you go.
Well, it is kind of, it's comfort food. And
sure.
Yeah, if you can't do a brisket, you could do a pot roast, kind of the same idea.
I do love pot roast.
My goodness.
It is. I'll tell you that the brisket in here is really good.
Is it?
Super good.
All right.
I'll tell you, it's really good. We had it a week ago tonight, I do believe.
Is it a family
first
recipe?
Night of Hanukkah, I think.
You called it welcome home brisket, right?
I did.
And it's something your boys love?
Yeah.
Is that how the name came about also?
That's how the name came about. You know, you're coming home from college the first time and what do you want for dinner?
Yep.
Welcome home brisket.
Yeah, you do.
So good. And mac and cheese. I was like, these boys, they're after my own heart for sure.
I know. It's like such comfort food. It's comfort food on top of comfort food. Oh, well.
Anytime I feel unwell and I have the ability to cook, I cook mac and cheese every time.
Yeah.
Like, it's just what makes you feel good.
It is.
Yeah. It does. Like, the cheesier and creamier, the better. Mm.
So I know you could not have anticipated this when you turned in your manuscript at the beginning of March, that the rest of the year would look how it has, and that this December and this winter, and we're, the solstice is what, Monday, would look like this. Mm. And the whole... the perfection of this book, one of the things, another thing that I've had a difficult time with is reading for very long. Magazine articles, fine, but I can't tell you how many books, wonderful books, I've started, gotten 35 pages into, and my mind's like, can't hold on to it, I don't know.
Yeah.
So these are, the whole thing feels like the kind of comfort you get from a brisket or a hug or a fuzzy blanket, because they're just the essays are just the perfect length for right now. And when you're a spiritual person, do you feel like there was some sacred alchemy into how this turned out for such a time as precisely this?
That would feel too pretentious to say, but I would say that it, you know, I didn't set out to write a survival guide for this winter or a survival guide for a pandemic, but what I hope this book does is that it accentuates the sometimes hidden blessing of this pared down time in our lives. Like, this is the first December where you don't really have to be countercultural to not be running madly all over the place, because nobody's running madly all over the place. And so the idea, the one idea here is to, you know, just take hold of the ordinariness, take mm-hmm. hold of these mm-hmm. quiet moments mm-hmm. that are upon us mm-hmm. and lift them, see them for the sacramental yes. they can be.
Yeah.
Right. See yep. the chance to sit at family dinner as a liturgical kind of
sacred moment. Space. Yeah, yeah. Part of that rhythm sacred of life. For
and,
sure.
And the conversations yeah. I've been having with friends this year have been around the constraints that are now in place around the holidays. Mm-hmm. And the debate-ish is whether to fight the constraint to have something that looks more normal or to embrace mm-hmm. the constraint and recognize that this is a once-in-a-lifetime Christmas holiday, God willing. Mm-hmm. And we... God willing. And lean in is such a dumb and overused phrase, but really embrace the way that we have been told to stay put instead of fighting it. Embrace it. Figure out ways to celebrate that stillness. And I feel that in your book really strongly, that mm-hmm. turn off, turn down, breathe in, like let it mm-hmm. all kind of settle a bit instead of going out and above and beyond the way that a lot of holidays kind of want to encourage.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, rather than chafing against the constraints, yes. just, you know, light the gosh darn fire. That's and right. sit in a room where home. The loudest sound in the room is the turning of a page.
Mm. Absolutely.
What a beautiful thing.
Absolutely. Unplugged. And I've even gotten to the point where I want this pandemic to be over. I will, as soon as somebody comes near, offers me a jab, and yeah. I'm right there because Maury and I are both immunocompromised, so we've really been locked down for many, many months. Mm-hmm. At first it was weird and scary, and then it became this beautiful gift of the time yep. that's just the two of us and the quiet. Mm-hmm. And I know that's not going to be around for very much longer. And there's a little bit of mourning, that change that's going to come up. And I hope that we don't go back to whatever normal was. I hope we don't go back to that. I don't think we will. Reimagine something. You know, they've heard me say this a million times. This, to me, feels like a cosmic timeout. Like the universe Absolutely. Just saying, everybody sit down. Mm-hmm. Like there's no way we're going to deal with any of the big issues or the small ones if you just stop talking, sit down, mm-hmm. listen to the birds that are going to return, listen to the heartbeat of your family, listen to each other.
Well,
we had a harder time doing that last bit.
Yeah, allow that change to happen to you, this change right. exactly. of the year. Like instead of fighting to make your life look as normal, quote unquote, as it used to, mm-hmm. instead mm-hmm. embrace the ways in which it is abnormal. Because
absolutely.
Because the fighting of it is such a waste of energy. It's not coming.
Exactly.
It's not going to be the way it used to be this year. So what mm-hmm. is it going to look like instead? You know?
Like I think of all the times, you know, there would be angst about, well, should we go to this thing or not go to this thing? Or, right. oh, we're going to this thing tonight. So, you
What's
know, hoist yourself out yeah. of the chair, throw some human clothes on.
Conflicting holiday parties.
Right. Yeah. yeah.
Right.
Two glasses of wine and we're out. That's it.
Exactly. Yeah. How many of those conversations do we not have to have this year?
We don't. Or the conversation about like, I can't wear that dress because I already wore it to this other party and was photographed on Instagram. So now I have to find something else to wear.
Oh my God.
There's none of that this year. In fact, a friend of mine posted that if this was the year that you were going to get rid of everything you hadn't worn in a year, she would be left with three pairs of leggings and a hoodie. She was like, this is not the year to follow that minimalist advice. You would have nothing left in your closet.
I know. I found myself standing in my closet going, oh, yeah. And I don't have very many clothes. But I was like, oh, yeah, that skirt. Oh, yeah.
Skirt.
Mm-hmm. Skirt. Yeah. Yeah, skirt.
I put on, as I said, hard pants once. And it was to make an appearance from a great distance at a friend's 50th birthday party. And I went, as the catering staff was setting up, mask dropped off the gifts, and as soon as people started to go, I was like, I'm out. So I wore hard pants for like 20 minutes and actual shoes.
I did the same thing today. I had enough energy to take a shower before I left the house, wow, which is a rarity lately. So I was like, screw it. I'm going to throw on a good-looking jacket. I'm going to throw on jeans. I'm going to dress to impress.
Good for you.
I didn't. And then realized when I got to the store, like, no one can compliment me or talk to me or smile at me because we're all staying so far away from each other that we can't see right. each other. But I know I looked good.
You know, that's important.
You know. Says the guy speaking from his clothes closet, by the way.
Broadcasting from a closet on Capitol Hill, literally.
Literally.
So, you know, all of what we've just said means that we're not having to give energy or seed energy to things that are inconsequential. So we have a lot of energy for other things, some of it taken up by, you know, trauma and panic and anxiety. But as creative people, and if you won't call yourself an artist, you can at least allow me to call you a creative because you certainly are that. Are you finding that that energy is going to different places, maybe surprising places for you, other than into your writing?
I think so. I think I'm carving out interesting little eddies of more sacred time than usual. I'm probably spending more creative time doing things in the kitchen. And more savoring more time outdoors, you know, in some way, shape, or form. I started a practice of morning prayer with the Book of Common Prayer. Every single, you know, I'm sinking into it. I don't always, like, I love the envelope of prayer full time. I'm not sure after I do the full cycle of a year if I'll just start to go search for writings that might fuel me in other ways. Some of the Hebrew Bible readings are alarming. Alarming.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. So they sneak up on you sometimes, or you'll get like a really beautiful epistle and the gospel's gorgeous. And then you're like, oh, what's happening in Habakkuk?
They were chopping people's eyes out. Really?
Kidnapping and a girl.
That's why I stick to Song of Songs.
Yeah.
Just Mark's Song favorite. Of Songs.
A little biblical humor. I never get to lay on anyone ever. And so this is the crowd that I'm doing it with. Thank you.
What made you start
He'll be back
with
next week, ladies and
the
gentlemen.
Book of Common Prayer?
So a couple of years ago, I kind of blundered my way into this amazing Episcopal church in Evanston, St. Luke's in Evanston.
Oh, yes.
And it's this big old stone church.
And a marvelous congregation.
Tiny little, the Lady Chapel, this tiny little Lady Chapel that has a completely stripped down, unadorned 8 o'clock mass in this intimate little space.
Ooh. Sounds right up my alley.
I mumbled into this place. A beloved Tribune editor died, and his widow just had like a gathering on a Sunday afternoon. There was no funeral, no nothing. This was way pre-COVID. And I found myself in this brilliant conversation with this woman who had a silk scarf around her neck. And we were talking about God and architecture, and it was a really wild conversation. And a few minutes in, maybe 15 minutes into the conversation, her silk scarf slid, and I saw this like collar, and I was like, wait a minute, who am I talking to? I was talking to this priest. This amazing, brilliant priest.
I did not know where that was going, as an aside.
Dog collar.
Where? As a person who watches a lot of horror movies and like a lot of weird stuff, I was like, go on. Oh, it's a priest collar. Yeah, that's usual in a church, right?
No, this was in someone's living room. Oh, it wasn't in a church. Come on. So then I knew that this editor was not like the kind of guy I knew to be a soulful guy, but his brother-in-law sidled over to this conversation and said, oh, you know, Kevin went to that church one Sunday for a concert 7 years ago and went every single Sunday the rest of his life.
Wow.
And I was kind of like, huh. And then I heard another great Tribune guy, Charlie Madigan, had stumbled into this church.
Seriously?
I know, right? And never left. So I was like, okay, I am really curious. So the next Sunday morning, I got in my car, I drove down there, and I was blown away. by the brilliant, brilliant, brilliant sermon from this priest who I thought I was like listening to C.S. Lewis or something. He was just like, you know, just drenched in Oxford.
Yeah.
Just brilliant.
The good kind.
So, so I seem to be a lifelong Catholic married to a Jew who's now going to Episcopal church.
That makes complete sense to me.
You know what?
Sliding farther into the mystic.
It is. This is the world in a microcosm, is this like global spirituality idea. I love it. Yeah.
So I don't even remember. What was the question?
How did you start with the Book of Common Prayer?
Oh, yeah. So
what made you start with that?
Yeah. This beautiful church. And then, you know, they started doing Zoom, various Zoomy things. And one Tuesday morning, a friend, someone I love from the church, he's a Franciscan, like
a lay friar.
Oh, yeah. Lay friar. I think he's now on his way toward priesthood, but he did morning prayer. And I zoomed into that morning prayer and was just weeping at the beauty and the richness of the language and the prayerfulness. And he invited me to follow along, to stay with it. And I became just so fascinated. I'm always really fascinated by the intersections of ancient Judaism and Christianity. And so fixed hour prayer has its roots and seeds in, you know, Jewish fixed hour prayer.
Yes.
And so I dove deep into it, and I'm just, I'm practicing it as I've practiced other things in my life, not knowing exactly where it's going to take me, but believing in the, you know, if I just carve out time and make space for it every single day, some gifts will come.
Accumulation of a sort.
Oh, yeah, for sure. But I love that you're just open to, like, let me just try this and see what. And I would imagine it's given some more shape to what feels to me like a perpetual Thursday afternoon that the last 9 months have been. Like, I most days I can't tell you what day it is. Unless we're taping, then I'm like, no, it's either a Tuesday or a Thursday. But, you know, the things that give you shape to your day, especially if you're doing it in the morning, it seems like a really wonderful, healthy practice, whether you're a writer or not, if you're doing something creative or not. It just seems like a great kind of grounding thing to do.
And it's you know, I get up early. It's still dark. Some mornings I light a candle. And I'm not doing it online. I bought this beautiful old, you know, Book of Common Prayer, those, you know, those tissue thin kind of pages.
Yes. I've got one upstairs. Yes.
And as a lifelong Catholic, I'm not, you know, I don't know scripture. So a lot of this is like, you know, just the language is so beautiful. So, I was reading a lot about the Psalms this summer. And anyway, it's been really beautiful.
I love that. I love that for you. But I love that for me too. I'm terrible at keeping up a discipline. I'm great at starting them very enthusiastically. And if I can get past the third week, then, you know, it'll stick. And I've tried this. You've given me inspiration to like try it again. See if it'll stick this time. Just to have some sort of, some sort of grounding.
Wonder if it has, and I've heard this said before by other spiritual directors and people, that there's a lot in a habit that is locked to a particular time of the day also. Something meditative, especially in the morning, has a large impact on the rest of your day and also your ability to continue to do it, because it's the beginning of all the things that happen when you're awake. So I wonder.
Right. If it was free floating through, like, oh, okay, I'm going to do this sometime today, wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
I wouldn't make it from Monday till Tuesday. But I also think, and somebody asked me recently, you know, what's your favorite prayer? And I said, you know, the prayer that just knocks my socks off every single morning is morning prayer begins with what I call like an act of confession. And I just think, especially in this American moment, where humility is so drastically lacking, to begin every day. And I know some people, you know, say their confessional prayers at night, like they kind of survey the day. But I just find it really beautiful to begin the day in this posture of, you know, just bent humility and saying, I'm sorry. Mm. Like, who, you know, where did I not love enough? Mm. Where did I fall short? And where can I love more today? Mm. Where and who can I love? Where and who and how can I love more today?
And it's got to be a good way to like strip away the stuff that didn't really matter because you've slept it over and forgotten about it. So when you wake up and it's still in your mind, it's something that needs to go away immediately or it will continue to sour the rest of your day.
Hmm. And it just sets your sights forward. And, you know, it seems that it just infuses, you know, if it's working any magic, it's that it sinks down deeper than you realize.
Do you think that it's infused some of your writing with the just the language of it? Like I notice if I watch or read anything of a particular genre or writer, mm-hmm. it influences like my daily speech patterns and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm working on a book right now, The Intersection of the Sacred and the Natural World. And so much of the Psalms and so much of the language from the Book of Common Prayer. I think just the other day I discovered a word. I keep lists. I have sort of a common, you know, a commonplace book where you, okay. So a word that I just recently put in there is the word holpen, H-O-L-P-E-N.
Ooh, that's new to me.
Which is, holpen. I know.
It's an like English word?
Yeah, it's an English word. And I thought, at first I was like, wait, is there a typo in the Book of Common Prayer? no, there's not. It's a form, like an antiquated form of, like, I believe it's like helping to the nth degree or something. I'll have to look it up. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But I think it's it comes from to help, but it's holpen.
Holpen.
So that, you know, yes. And some of the language seeps in and, you know, maybe more for me, it's a recognition of, oh, that beautiful phrase I've always heard. This is where it comes from. You know, just some of the phraseology is exquisite.
We've been talking for about 45 minutes and I think you've introduced me to like 7 new words. So
we're going to make flashcards.
Yeah. I probably made half of them up, so don't count on them.
I love like it. So did Shakespeare. You know what? So did Shakespeare. So you know what? Go at it. Let's do it. Yes.
Good precedent.
I love when I'm reading something and I have to stop and look up a word. I absolutely love that. Our son, you know, who learned English later in life because he spent the first 9 years of his life in Africa where they didn't really speak English. It was the bane of his existence to have to constantly be stopping to look things up. And when I would get so giddy and joyful about it, he's just like, I don't, Mom, that's nuts. What are you talking
about?
Too much work.
It's crazy.
Right. I get excited to write down where, especially if I'm reading, you know, some wonderfully lyrical Irish writer. And there's always some word in there that I'm like, that's why Seamus Heaney was so good, because their language, it's the same language, but it's so much richer than our American English can be sometimes. Although Mary Oliver would probably argue that with us, I suppose. But
She might.
You know, I was futzing with the book because I knew I had marked one of the chapters with your prayers in it. And this is this predating your engagement in this daily way with the Book of Common Prayer?
Anything from here would be, yes. It would be predating, yes. But I do write prayers sometimes on pulpit chair.
Well, it's, they're just beautiful. Would you be willing to perhaps read?
Sure.
The selection
I'm
thinking
of. Read?
It's the chapter, Morning Prayer for Christmas. I love all of it, but I love when you talk about, it's on page 54, here's my prayer, or at least the first draft of it.
Yep.
And then go on from there.
So you want me to start at, here's my prayer. Okay.
Although if you want to read the introduction that's on the setup on the page before it, it's just a couple of paragraphs long. That would be fine too. Whatever feels.
Read us a story, Barbara.
I know.
I had like six of them picked out. I'm like, the first one, no, later of the epiphany. Wait, no, first of the year. But I think the prayers are what are calling to me right now.
Oh, I love that you're going with what calls to you. I will just start with, I wrote a tiny little, so yes, there's an introduction. Then there's a tiny, tiny prelude that I will read. I'll skip the prelude and I'll just go right into the prayer. Here's my prayer, or at least the first draft of it. I pray for the mothers who have buried a child, the mothers for whom Christmas will never be whole, will ever be hollow. I pray and pray for peace, just a thread of it, to come to them, to wrap for a moment around their aching heart. I pray for one moment's relief from the stinging emptiness that will not be staunched. I pray for the children who've lost their mother, two in particular I know and love, and countless others I've read about, countless others who cling to the margins of all the merriment. For children without a mother on Christmas, there is no peace, no everlasting peace. I pray for the men and the women, cold, hopeless, hungry. I pray for the war-shattered masses left to die in the rubble, awaiting the words, any words, that tell them the world is listening, has heard their cries, awaiting the word that the world is coming, hope is coming to save them. I pray for the weary souls I see lying under puffy layered sleeping bags, on cold, hard sidewalks, under viaducts, against the grates at the base of shimmering downtown towers. I pray for my children. I pray that in their hours of darkness, the light comes, that they see how brilliantly they shimmer in the landscape of my heart and my soul. I pray that someday they understand just how wholly they filled me, how they put purpose to my being alive, that each and every day we try and try again to teach each other, this is how you love. I pray for all of us who more often than not of late feel hallowed, feel jarred and broken by the hatred spewing around, all around. I pray for our tender hearts and fragile spirits. I pray that we don't topple. And if we do, I pray for someone strong to come along, to reach out a hand, to whisper hope and pull us to our feet. I pray for those who haven't a clue how deeply they teach me each and every day, be it a story on the news, or one passing by in the social media world, or someone I bump into at the grocery store, or riding the train, or shivering in the cold as I shuffle down the sidewalk. I pray for the ones who we've lost this year, the ones whose words rumble through my head, through my heart, each and every day. I pray especially for my friend who wrote these words, quote, "Wake up every morning acknowledging just how much beauty is in your world. Pay attention to it, honor it, and keep your heart and your eyes wide open. You won't regret it," she promised. I pray for the God who catches the words of this prayer, who catches us all. More mightily than any prayer I pray of late, I beg, holy God, not to abandon us now, to not leave us to our sins and our shattered promises. I promise to love a little bit harder, to love more true to the blessing I was made to be. And this is the prayer I pray most mightily. I promise to love God, and I beg you to show us, show me, show every single lost and hungry one of us the way, the holy certain way. Amen.
So, so beautiful, Barbara.
Thank you.
Thank you for Thank you.
Wow. You're saying you didn't write that for COVID?
Right.
Because... every word of that is touching in so many ways
this year,
to anyone who knows anyone who's been paying attention this year. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Like the line about, you know, losing mothers and things like that.
It's
like, I'm just like, wow. Like.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I wrote, I mean, I think some of the rubble line comes directly from Syrian.
Yeah.
That was Syria. Yeah.
And those people still displaced, still on the move in the midst of a plague. Thank you so much for that. Thank you for everything that you've, you know, given us in this beautiful little book. What you're working on a new project, a new book you mentioned. Can you say a little bit more about that?
It's a project I really love, really, really love. When Slowing Time first came out, I was on a radio show with this wonderful Rabbi Rami Shapiro, who was talking about Slowing Time. And he said, it reads like Midrash to the Book of Nature. And I was like, Midrash? Like my ears perked up at Midrash because I am fascinated, like deep into the world of all things, you know, Jewish. Jewish spirituality is really, really powerful to me. But I was like, what's this book of nature? Like, how do I not know about this book of nature? Like capital B, capital N.
Right.
So I explored and of course have discovered that it's this like ancient, ancient school of theology in which God gave us two holy sacred texts, one creation and one scripture.
That's right.
Scripture, the word.
So the book of nature is the natural world.
Exactly. So, and then, you know, I was raised by this mom who we jokingly refer to her as the original Mother Nature because she had us all in the woods and she would be taking family movies and she was taking pictures of the scarlet tanager and the, you know, indigo bunting and never mind the five kids. So I just kind of grew up, you know, enveloped by the natural world. And so I'm writing a book that is looking deep into the, you know, all the thinkers through time. I mean, Mary Oliver is just one of the latest disciples of the Book of Nature, but, you know, Thoreau and Emerson and Emily Dickinson and, you know, on and on and on, Julian of Norwich,
yes.
You name it.
Oh, yes.
So I've been reading all those people and it will, you know, be an exploration of the Book of Nature and paying attention and stillness. And then, you know, essays reflecting various pages from the Book of Nature.
Oh, I
you know,
those love things that most stir me. Is it Abingdon, I guess, again?
No, it's not. It's my original editor who's now at a new publisher, and she asked me to do it for her.
That's great.
Lil Copan was my first.
Come on. I know Lil. Are you talking about Broadleaf? Of course you're talking about Broadleaf. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
The world of publishing is so incestuous. And then it's even more so when you get into like spiritual and Christian publishing. Oh my goodness. That's great. When's that going to come out?
I'm supposed to turn it in June 1st, but I'm not, given the craziness in my family right now.
Oh, please. Yeah.
I just sent Lil a note yesterday and I said, you know, anytime I leave my computer, I'm feeling really guilty. Can we just like, so we'll
see. Give me a minute. Right. So is any of the material in the book going to be coming from your blog or will you be coming?
No.
No, it's completely separate.
This will be the first, it'll be all brand new, which is.
That's great and scary, right? And a lot of work.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh,
exactly.
I love this. Do you have a tentative title for it?
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
The other book of nature.
You have to let us know.
There you go.
Are you going to write Midrash? I love it.
So the morning prayer thing is almost like daily practice for writing this book, right? Mm. Like essentially you wake up in the morning and you do sort of a meditation of sorts to align yourself up with this exactly
the
what
world.
You're talking about. Yeah.
The world and
you're and seeing the world coming alive. In
exactly.
The
exactly.
In the
exactly.
dark.
Right.
And it was kind of wonderful. I mean, basically what I've done during pandemic is, you know, you can't see, but I have 150 books that I read this summer for this project.
Okay, I'm having the problem.
Sorry.
150 books.
I'm sorry. Wow. Did I just hear 150 books?
I can't even name 150 books.
But, see, that's because I was a nurse. I went to nursing school. And when you're in nursing school, you have like, I went to a Jesuit college. So I had
there
lots
it is.
Of biology, biochemistry, anatomy and physiology, and clinicals. And I didn't have any history or English classes. So
right,
I have
so
to
you're
read
educating yourself. But
yes,
even
exactly.
still, that's a tremendous amount of reading, which
It was wonderful.
I don't ever have trouble with, but I have had trouble with it this year in that I've read a lot less this year than I normally do.
But I was reading for a purpose, which I think
that
helps.
Does help.
You know,
yeah, it feels feels more like work, but it's pleasurable work in a sense. Mm. Yeah.
Research. And it kept me from feeling guilty that I wasn't doing anything. Mm-hmm. I was reading.
This is research. I'm reporting. Mm-hmm. I could still put that hat on. It's like, no, this is research for me.
Yeah.
I can get deep into research and never get around to the writing part of it sometimes. But
I keep worrying that that's kind of what's happening. I have hundreds of pages of notes. I'm like, you'll have to stop with the notes.
Meister Eckhart, did you get that into?
Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Oh, my God. Yes. Lots and lots and lots and lots.
So this is not easy. Some of this is pretty dense, esoteric reading, too. So she's not breezing through, like, you know, 10 thoughts about God.
K.R. Deschardin. Oh, yeah. I was like, what?
I know. That's a tough one. Oh, my gosh.
I kind of put Divine Milieu over to the side. I decided we're not going to
come back for that later.
Yeah. I'm bad at that kind of reading. Even in school, I was like, it's boring and I don't want to. I'm going to not do it. Is really the answer.
It's more interesting than an anatomy and physiology book. Let me tell you that. Okay. Maybe my bar is a little lower.
Probably true. Apart from the 150. That's staggering books that you read this summer. are there other forms of art that you've been consuming in this past weird year that have been life-giving, heartening, inspiring?
Poetry and binge watching, I would say.
Same. Talk to us about binge watching.
Yeah. What are you watching?
Oh gosh. Well, what are we watching right now? So my adorable son, who is now living in your part of the world, he's up in Portland, Oregon for a year.
In the PNW.
Said that we really, really need to watch. We're like the last people in America to watch The Sopranos. But he says the writing is really amazing.
It is phenomenal. We just went back to it for the first time.
The storytelling, not just the writing, but the storytelling and the character development is really incredible.
And through the frame of the psychotherapy, I love that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's dark.
You know,
really beautiful.
On bad days when we just need like a little light something or other, it's been British Baking Show.
I love that show so much.
Yeah. I've watched every single episode.
Are you a Paul Hollywood fan? Are you a Prue fan? Are you a Mary Berry
fan? Silverback.
Mary Berry.
But I like Prue, but I'm OG Mary Berry.
Yeah, I do like Mary Berry, but Paul Hollywood all the way, every day,
you know,
all the time.
I love Noel. I love him.
I really liked the original two ladies that were the sidekicks.
We're sticking to the originals. We just keep recycling the originals.
Those were my favorites. Sue and Mel, I think.
Sue and Mel. Yeah.
They had a previous relationship. Like, they were a comedy duo before. Mm-hmm. And you can sense that
that makes sense then.
Yeah. They were like Saunders and French.
Oh, yeah. Or Hugh and Laurie. Right. Yeah. That British tradition.
And then I think they left when Mary left, or Mary left when they left, and that's when they got Prue.
And Noel.
And then it's sort of and it didn't go the same way.
Yeah.
It isn't the same. But the construct of the show is still so great. It really does supersede even the hosts.
In this season that just finished airing, it was all shot during COVID.
So the entire
cast and their entire crew were quarantined together at this hotel and grounds. And, it was
the proverbial
bubble.
It had
a very different vibe to it. So people knew each other really well.
Interesting.
You know, there's always bonding. Watching? Yes, very much so.
And I haven't seen a good one. I haven't seen the most recent season.
It just finished 2 weeks ago. So
if you aren't a Paul Hollywood fan, this will make you a Paul Hollywood fan.
I'm gonna marry him, so don't even worry about it.
Paul in this newest season becomes so much softer and
really
nicer,
because that's what I don't like about him.
Oh no, I'm gonna say I'm the way with you.
Like,
I just
so
go like
he's a little
people.
He's more gentle in this
I like it.
Season because
he's
I think in part he's living there.
Yeah.
With them.
Yeah.
And he's just grateful to be there. Like, he's not like Paul Hollywood, you know, the king of bread. He's like Paul Hollywood, just like everybody else living in this hotel, trying not to die.
Right.
And so you can sense the, like, the appreciation for being able to be there. Mm. And it is like, I think it's like, it's not my favorite season, but it's up there for sure.
I would say so too. It's so different.
I want like candid footage off the record, behind the scenes of that kind of thing. Like a bubble of people that are filming a TV show or a movie or whatever. What happens behind that in the hotels with the Sturm und Drang of all the people interacting?
Isn't that that's what the Bachelor is about?
Yeah.
Like, but and not I'm like, that.
I've never seen it. I haven't either.
We've watched a couple of episodes. It's really not my favorite kind of reality show.
Yeah.
That's me.
Well, and poetry. I've bought more poetry. I've always loved poetry, but I have bought more volumes of poetry this year than my entire life put together before. Like, it was just the kind of, because I could read poetry. I don't have.
Right.
And poetry, I always like to ask this question of other writers. And we kind of asked it of Lucy when she was on with us, Lucy Shaw, but what is it about poetry that in times of great trauma, we're drawn to it? What do you think that is?
It's the distillation of, you know, it's boiled down whatever is the broth to its just densest, most intense essence. So, you know, the economy of language in poetry is just like, you just get volumes out of a particular twist or a particular utterly unexpected word that is so perfect. How did they get it? Yeah. It could only be divinely inspired.
How long did it take you to get that word? That word, that one. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Did you do that on first try?
No way.
Yeah. You know what I just got? I'm the last one. It's, you know, blame it on my nerves. I just got yesterday a book of Jefferson Robbins?
Starship?
Right? Robinson Jeffers.
Robinson Jeffers.
Yeah. He was like, you know, Auden, Eliot.
Really?
He was And his, The Something of
Never
the Wild God.
Him.
The Something of the Wild God.
Writing
I know.
Down.
Same.
I know. I read the title and said, oh, and I read a couple poems from it. And I tried to get it from my local library because that's what I'm trying to do first round, but they couldn't find it. So I bought it.
You said Robinson Jeffers or Jefferson Robbins?
Robinson Jeffers. Robinson Jeffers. I probably said.
I wrote down both. Robinson I was like, Jeffers. One of these people is going to be a thing.
That's a good one.
Yeah, he's good. Oh my goodness. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. Yeah, my poetry books are going to like fall down and kill me.
Oh yeah.
Now horizontal.
You and Kathleen are both going to be discovered under like 500 poetry books.
This is just Irish poetry here. But they, you know, that they're all those, I have so many of the little slim, because poetry is so hard to, God bless the poets. It's thankless to try to get published. And they're always these little slim volumes that are kind of slick and they fall in between things. I'm forever like when I change the linens on our bed, I'm like, oh, there's one. Who is that? Denise Lieberdorf. There she is. I forgot about that one.
Tucked down in the corner somewhere.
I know.
We've got all this bed imagery going on. We've got
as we began, so we shall end.
We've got flying poetry sheeps.
Oh my gosh. What do you, maybe I'll ask the question and this can sort of be our denouement, if not the final.
I have one final. I do have a final question.
I have one as well.
Yeah.
Okay, fine.
We'll go one, two, three. No. It's okay. Kathleen had one, so go ahead.
I was going to say, what I find that whatever I read at night, right before I go to bed, if I in fact do that, is something usually very different than what I'm reading during the day. If that's true for you, what have you been reading at night?
I always get it. Is it understory or overstory? It's like every story is about a tree. Oh God, it's up. It's next to my bed. Oh. Understory.
Understory.
Isn't it? Mm-mm. Yeah. Understory. It won National Book Award.
This year, it won the National Book Award.
No, I think 2 years ago.
Understory.
It's really beautiful. Okay. It feels like a collection of individual short stories, and each one has at its root a tree. some kind of just incredible connection to a tree. And I think these characters are going to intertwine by the end of the book.
Lovely. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And now I will step back and let my colleagues ask you things.
Go ahead, Mark. You had a question.
Mr. Closet.
Mr. Closet.
Mr. Closet.
I don't mind that moniker. That's nice. What is your guilty pleasure read? Like the thing that you kind of don't tell people that you read, but you read? Like, is there a thing that you're like, oh, that's really terrible magazine, but you know, it's interesting. Like, do you read a People magazine? Do you read, is there anything like that that maybe is underrated in some
way? My guilty pleasure of today was I did read, I thought it was terrible, like poor Jeffrey Toobin, like,
seriously.
But I read it.
I read it.
I was like, oh, I can't believe that. And oh, why is Masha Gessen saying that about him? And then I read every word of it.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I get it. Yep.
So, it's like a Twitter thread that you just can't stop following. It's just like,
yeah, pulling. I would say Twitter would be my guilty pleasure.
Yeah, like, that is a guilty pleasure. Yeah.
I try to carefully follow smart people, but then I chase crazy.
Who's the dumbest person you follow on Twitter?
Who's the dumbest person?
Who knows? Who
are you? I have to know. I'm going to say dumb people all the time.
Jeffrey Toobin of late, but yeah.
I guess, yeah, if you follow Jeffrey Toobin, yeah.
Yeah, some compassion for him, actually. Mm. Feel real bad. Mm. All right, I'm going to change gears from, you know, people who got fired for inappropriate behavior on Zoom. None of us are going to be Debs people. So it's Christmas almost. What's your favorite Christmas tradition that you're gonna be able to do this year, even under the COVID precaution?
It's not gonna sound too dissimilar from my other favorite things to do, but I love to get up really early on Christmas morning and crank the oven and put something in the oven and the smells waft up the stairs.
Barbara, I'm coming to your house right now. I'm on my way.
Yep.
And I go outside and feed my birds and I sit by the tree all by myself. Mm. It's going to be really hard this year because my beloved firstborn is not coming home from Portland and we've never had Christmas without him. Mm. And I kind of can't even really start to wrap my head around it.
Yeah. We're without our boy this year too for the first time, and that's just
So it's the mark of the year.
I'll be thinking
in
of
many
you.
Ways. Yeah, that this is a different year than every other. And
by the way, thank you for writing about your smell pot because I have done that since I was a kid, and we call it the smell pot. And I haven't done it this year. And I was reading, I was like, I haven't done that.
I
love you.
Absolutely going to do that.
I have all the stuff.
Yeah,
it's so cozy.
For those listening who don't know what a smell pot is, please explain what a smell pot is.
So smell is this little pot. I got a red pot a few years ago because it just had to be red. Yep. It's a tiny pot from Target.
And it's like a regular, like a put a plant
in. You can put it on the stove.
No, on the stove.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, on the stove. Yeah, and I put in star anise, which is the luxury spice because it's luxury. It smells so good. And just handful of cloves, like 6 cloves, a bay leaf, orange peel, a cinnamon stick, and water. Mm-hmm. And then you just turn the burner really low and like let it simmer all day long until the pot burns.
Christmas-y.
It's great.
And actually,
and how much fun that I put it in a bowl.
Yeah, I love that you did that.
I did too.
Because it reminded me.
Yeah. And I was like, if you dried those orange peels, you could actually package it and give it away as gifts over the season, over the Christmas season. You could a little cloth bag that they could just drop in water and
that's what I do with my orange peels every morning. I just throw them in a bowl and
that was
dry
actually another like
pretty.
Life hack from your book that I was like, that's what I should do because we go through so many
oranges
here, but I never think I'm forever like making peels to put in like the odd old fashioned or whatever, and I should just have a bowl of peels.
Totally. Ugh. Gosh, I love that.
Worth the price of admission, Barb.
It is.
There you go.
Yeah, I spend like $30 on a candle that smells the same way, and I could just do it for free at home. So no, thank you.
Yeah. You have to buy the spices.
Save me hundreds of dollars.
It would save you hundreds. Yeah,
it would. It would.
Yeah.
And you could use it as Kathleen's, what was it, an old fashioned? You put it in your old fashioned?
I put an orange peel in an old fashioned, you know, and instead of just
so classy.
But if we were just keeping the orange peels, that we had eaten, there would be a reserve of them there for the stink pot or the smell pot, or Mort calls it the stink pot, and or for, you know, various cocktail occasions. But
yeah, or if you distilled that same recipe down into like a syrup, it would be an amazing accompaniment to a cocktail, actually.
There you go.
It would indeed. And festive. Christmas in a cup. Anyway.
Yeah.
I love it. All right, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today for this episode. If you'd like to hear more about the artists we talked to today, you can go to our website at artistcareandfeeding.com. You'll find social links for the artists and websites and possibly some video clips. You will also find a tip jar, so please throw some money in there and help feed the artists. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. If you want to drop us a line, please email us at artistcareandfeeding@gmail.com. We would like to thank Martin Hanlon and Eric Escalante for the theme music and Kurt Leitner for our logo art. Thanks so much for listening. Please come back.